Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Okay, so I'm going to get started in our retreat by just officially welcoming all of you guys. Sawadee kap, welcome. Welcome to Wat Tung Yu. This is our international Buddhist meditation and study retreat where you're going to be able to learn the path to enlightenment. And the things that I'm going to be sharing with you over the next 5 days is going to help you to be able to learn all the teachings you need to get to the first stage of enlightenment. There are certain foundational teachings that you'll understand within the first 2 days. And then the latter 2 days, I'm going to be sharing with you teachings specifically to get to the first stage of enlightenment. Now, some of you guys have studied with me in other classes or courses and retreats where you've learned the foundational teachings, but this time when I'm teaching them, I'm going to be teaching them in the same way I have before, but now I'm going to be paying special attention to certain areas that you're going to need to understand in order to get to that first stage of enlightenment, along with various teachings that you're going to need specifically to get to the first stage of enlightenment. This first stage of enlightenment is very important because once you get to that first stage, you're going to get to enlightenment at some point, either in this life or some future life. It's just a matter of time. So getting to that first stage is vitally important. I'm going to share with you the benefits of getting to that first stage of enlightenment as we get started. But to get started, I would like to just welcome all of you guys here at the temple and those of you guys that are joining us online. So feel free to make yourself at home because we're going to be here for a few days over the next several days. Some of you guys I know are going to be coming and going at different times. You know, you're going to another country or and things like this. So feel free to come and go as you please. You're going to see other people joining us as we go through the week because there are certain people that are planning to be here, but they couldn't be here today for one reason or another. So they might join us tomorrow. So you'll see our class is go up and down in terms of the size and the people that are here. But if you're interested in learning and have a sincere interest in understanding what it takes to get to the first stage of enlightenment, this is the perfect retreat for you. And I thought the best way to start off is to start you off the same way that I start off all students who are learning with me for the very first time, is I share with you a bit of information that's going to help you kind of approach the teachings of the Buddha in the way that's going to produce the best results for you. And that is that you don't believe anything that I share. You don't believe anything that I write in books or anything that we ever talk about. Because with belief, you don't know what's true or false. And this isn't going to help you get to enlightenment. The teachings of the Buddha aren't about believing a bunch of things and then hoping that something good happens when you die. Instead, you're learning teachings, you're reflecting on them, and you're practicing them in order to transform the mind and train the mind, uproot certain pollutions that are in the mind. And you can't do that through belief. So the way that you get to enlightenment is you learn teachings, you investigate them, you examine them. So as I'm teaching you this week and any other time, you can ask questions. We have the ability for you guys to ask questions and get clarity. I'm sure that the things that I'm going to be sharing with you are certain things that you don't necessarily know right now. You may not have even considered before. And it's going to conflict with certain things that you've been thinking about throughout your life. So when you come to those situations where what I'm sharing with you conflicts with what you currently understand, that's a great time for you to ask questions. Because if you're in a class with a teacher where you understand and you already know all the things that they're sharing with you, that's not a good class for you to be in. You're not actually learning. You're not actually growing and developing and learning new things and challenging the things that you currently think you understand. So as I share things with you throughout this week, there's going to be things that you either don't understand or it conflicts with what you currently understand, and you're going to need to ask questions. So learning, investigating, examining the teachings through listening and understanding, but then also asking questions during class or at other times, that's really helpful for you. Then after after you're doing the learning and that intellectual understanding starts to come in, you would like to start reflecting on the teachings. This is where you independently verify the teachings. Everything in the teachings of the Buddha, you can independently verify for yourself. And where you're having difficulty seeing how to do that, that's where you can ask me, David, how do I independently verify that? And I will guide you in how to independently verify things. A lot of times when I'm teaching, I'm going to be sharing things with you to learn, then I'm going to show you how to independently verify it on your own, and then I will teach you how to practice it. But where you don't see me sharing that, or you're confused about how to independently verify something, ask me those questions so that you can reflect and get to the wisdom to understand the truth about the world around you. Then you can practice the teachings. That's where you're actually uprooting certain pollutions. You're applying the tools and the techniques that the Buddha taught you in order to train your mind to move to this enlightened mental state. The Buddha didn't teach the way that the world should be. He didn't teach a bunch of rules or commandments. He taught you the way the world is. And through understanding how the world is, you will navigate the world more readily and do it in a wiser way that produces wholesome results for you. Whereas if you don't understand the world that you live in, it can be a real struggle. And this is where, when the mind's experiencing sadness and anger and frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, boredom, loneliness, shyness, resentment, jealousy, displeasure, all of these types of feelings and others like stress and anxiety, this is all coming from a mind that is struggling. There's certain wisdom that you don't have yet, and the mind's struggling in that situation. So the way that you get to improvement in the condition of the mind and your life is you need to get to wisdom so that you learn something, you reflect on it to independently verify it, and you practice it. And that's where you'll know what the truth is. And now with this wisdom, you'll make wiser decisions that produces wholesome results. But when you lack wisdom, you will naturally make unwise decisions that produces unwholesome results. And we did this exact same thing when we were growing up, that as we were growing up, we didn't understand the natural law of gravity. And we struggled in the world. We fell down, we hit our head, we bumped our elbow, we broke open our knee, we fell off our bicycle, we had all kinds of difficulties. We broke our toys and other things like this. And we cried and we were upset and we were really struggling in this world and we didn't understand this natural law of gravity. And this natural law of gravity affected us, whether we were aware of it or not. So these natural laws that the Buddha taught, he's helping you to understand how the world is. He's not explaining how the world should be. And if everybody follows these rules, then we'll get to peacefulness. He's explaining to you the way the world is so that you can awaken to this wisdom, understanding how the world is, and now you can navigate this world more readily. Because when you cultivated wisdom about the natural law of gravity, you started making different decisions. You started tying your shoes a bit tighter. You started looking at the surface of the sidewalk as you were walking. We stopped being so giddy and bouncing around as kids so we didn't fall down as much. We started practicing riding our bike and balancing ourselves on this bicycle. And now we're at the point where not only can we ride a bicycle, we can ride a motorbike, we can climb ladders, we can get on airplanes, we can do all kinds of things because we fully awoke to the wisdom of the natural law of gravity. And we don't struggle with it anymore. And we make all kinds of wise decisions that produces wholesome results. But when we lack wisdom of the natural laws of existence, we'll make those unwise decisions naturally and it'll produce unwholesome results. So as we gain wisdom about these natural laws of existence that the Buddha taught through learning, reflecting, and practicing, now you'll navigate the world with wisdom. You'll make wise decisions that produces wholesome results. So that's what learning the teachings of the Buddha are. You're learning about meditation. You're learning about how to train your mind. You're learning about the world around you. Essentially, what you're doing is you're on this journey for this inner growth and this inner development. Essentially, you're learning how to heal from what hurt you so that you never need to hurt ever again. By the time you get to enlightenment, you will never experience any painful feelings ever again. It's impossible for an enlightened being to experience sadness or anger or frustration or irritation or any of those discontent feelings that I talk about. It's physically impossible for the mind to ever experience those things again. So when we talk about awakening, what we're doing is we're gaining wisdom. That's what it means to awaken. You're gaining wisdom through learning, reflecting, and practicing. And you're on your own independent journey to be able to do that. And a teacher is here to guide you. We're here to provide you resources, opportunities to learn, show you the way, point the way towards enlightenment, but it's up to each individual student to choose to walk that path and learn and grow and develop and ask questions. So keep that in mind as we're going throughout this week and throughout your journey in this life, is that you're not interested in believing anything. Don't believe me, don't believe the books, don't believe anything that I present to you, but dig into it, roll up the sleeves and ask questions. And I'm going to provide you plenty of opportunities to be able to do that. As you guys would like to ask questions as we go in our retreats or any other times that you're here, I'm typically live streaming or having people that are online that are joining us. There's people here with us now. And if you guys could use the microphones here at the temple, there's a bowl of microphones there that you could actually take one and keep it with you throughout the morning or throughout the evening as we have various sessions. And then if there's someone next to you that needs it, you can pass it around. There's a gray button on the front that it just takes about a second for the lights to turn on and the microphone to turn on. And if you hold it up to your chin, then we'll be able to hear you here at the temple and they'll be able to hear you online as well. And then when you're done, you can just turn it off. And there's six microphones there, so you can pass them around and probably even keep one with you throughout the time so that we don't have to, you know, send them across the room back and forth. So you can use these microphones here. And for those of you guys that are online through Facebook, YouTube, and Zoom, you can ask questions by putting that into the comment section. I'll be able to see that and answer your question. And if you're in Zoom, you can electronically raise your hand and ask any questions or follow-up questions directly. We'll be able to hear you through our speakers here at the temple. So again, welcome to everyone. Really pleased to see that you guys are here, and it's going to be wonderful to share these teachings of the Buddha with you. And as we go, one of the wonderful things about getting together in a retreat is you're going to get to meet lots of new people and get to be able to build new relationships. And we've built that kind of thing into our schedule that we can take nice long breaks, 15, 20, 30 minute breaks in between various topics. And then we also have the daytime break from 12:30 to 6:30, where we'll be able to do free time and have different activities if you guys would like to come on any of the scheduled activities and or do anything that you guys would like to do on your own. So I'm going to share with you about the retreat and how it's set up and the structure of the retreat and all of that stuff so that you can learn it and understand it. But before we get to all of that stuff, I thought the best topic to really start with is helping you guys to understand this person that we refer to as the Buddha or Gautama Buddha. I thought what I would do is share his life story with you so that you can understand his life story. And I'm going to use these visual aids. So let me switch over here so the people online can see the visual aids as well. Understanding a bit about the life story of the Buddha can be really helpful because you can understand his journey to enlightenment. So I'm going to share this with you. And usually what I do here is I just talk all the way through to be able to help you. But you'll see when I teach normally, I kind of pause about every 15 or 20 minutes to be able to open up to questions. But here, let me just share with you a bit about the life story of the Buddha so you understand who this person is that you're going to be learning his teachings. This individual that we refer to as Gautama Buddha, I'm going to organize this talk around discussing his birth, his early life, his journey to enlightenment, and then his teaching career and what really motivated him to go on this journey to enlightenment. And I'll even explain to you what a Buddha is so that you understand what a Buddha is. This individual that we refer to as Gautama Buddha, he was born with the name Siddhartha Gautama. He was born to a queen. His mother was a queen and his dad was the king. He was born in what we refer to as Nepal today, but back then that border between Nepal and India didn't exist. So he was born in that place where we refer to as Nepal, and he taught in Northeast India. And when he was born, his mother, of course, was pregnant. And during this period of time, the way that it was set up is that if you were pregnant as a woman, you would go back to your homeland in order to deliver the baby. So while she was living with the king, her husband, when it was time to deliver the baby and getting close to delivery, they organized a caravan and they started taking her back towards her homeland so that she could deliver the baby with her parents and her family and so forth. And as she was making her way back, she went into labor pains. So they stopped the caravan and she gets out, she goes over to a tree and she holds on to the branch of a tree and she's trying to deliver the baby standing up and trying to get this baby out through the birthing canal. But the baby wouldn't come out. So it ends up breaking through the side of her stomach and she ends up dying 7 days later. This was 2,500 years ago because we didn't have the medical technology to save her life. Where nowadays we would do a C-section because the baby couldn't come out and it would be really easy to allow the woman to continue to live. There'd be no issues. But back then, it wasn't uncommon for a woman to die during childbirth and even for the child to die as well. So his mom died 7 days after his birth. And because this was somewhat common, that they actually had protocols in place of what would happen if the mom died during childbirth. And your siblings would typically adopt your children as their own. So his stepmother was actually his aunt. His mother had an older sister who adopted him to be her child. It was said that when he was born, that he immediately walked, that there was lotus flowers blossoming under his feet, and he spoke and he said, "This will be my last life." But I don't suspect that this part of the story is actually true, even though it's written in the original source teachings of the Buddha. And the reason why I say that is because if this part of the story was true, the next part of the story wouldn't actually be needed. Sometimes as teachings are handed down from generation to generation, people embellish the story of an individual, because if you have somebody like the Buddha who did some amazing things during his life, sometimes people will embellish that story in order to make him better than he actually already is. And we don't need to embellish the story of the Buddha because he did amazing things during his life. So I suspect that people embellish this story, and it doesn't really matter if he had lotus flowers blossoming under his feet or he walked or what have you, because we have his teachings and they lead to enlightenment, and that's what's important. Well, if that actually occurred, the next part of his story wouldn't be needed, because the next part of the story is that his father summoned advisors to come advise him what his son was going to become, essentially fortune tellers. Well, if your son was born and they started walking right away and they started talking and there was lotus flowers blossoming under their feet, you probably don't need people to tell you what this person's going to become, because you know this is a pretty special being, right? So he needed advisors to come tell him what his son was going to become. And there was 108 advisors who came and talked to the father, the king, and advised him what his son was going to become. 107 of those advisors told his father that his son was going to be a great monarch, a great ruler. He was going to expand his territory and be this great king. And his father is like, yeah, that's my boy. Okay, yeah, let's go, right? Like, the father's feeling good about that. Right? But then there's this one advisor, the 108th one, came in and he apologized to the king. And he said, "Sir, I'm so sorry. I heard the other advisors and they're 100% correct that your son is going to be a great leader, but not in the way that you think. He's not going to be a king and a monarch and rule over your territory. He's actually going to be a great spiritual leader." And his father didn't like this. So he decides that he's going to sequester his son into the palace just in case this fortune teller might be correct. He thought that it's best to sequester his son in the palace and not let him go outside and get involved in worldly affairs where he might be interested in being a spiritual leader. So he keeps his son in the palace. He kind of tries to woo him into the ways of being a monarch. If you can imagine a royal family having lots of money, he gave him, you know, wonderful food and clothing and lots of fabrics that would be able to clothe him and feel, you know, very rich and very luxurious. He had beautiful women bathing him and taking care of him. He gave him great entertainment, all the things that money could buy. And he was trying to woo him into the ways of being a monarch because he knew that there was no way that he could ever live the same lifestyle as a spiritual leader. Well, by the age of 29, Siddhartha Gautama gets to the point where he's about to become the king. Because during this time, at the age of 30, you would become the king and your dad would retire and essentially be there to help you to learn how to become a better and better king. So at the age of 29, with Siddhartha Gautama realizing he's about to become the king and he's never even been outside the palace to understand what the life was like in the kingdom, how could he ever be a ruler over these people if he's never even been outside the palace? So without his father knowing, he snuck outside the palace with his royal attendant, kind of like his chief of staff. And when he goes outside the palace, he has these four observations. This is what we call it, the four observations. This is what motivated him to be able to go on this journey to enlightenment. He sees a sickly person, he sees an aging person, and he sees a dead corpse, as well as a roaming aesthetic, someone who's given up worldly possessions to be able to seek a better understanding of life. And it was these four observations that motivated him to go on this journey to enlightenment. Because when he saw the sickly person, he saw something that he had never seen before. He saw this disgruntledness, this anger, this hostility, this bitterness. And he needed to ask people, like, what's going on over there? Why are they so upset? Why are they so angry? And the chief of staff or his royal attendant says, oh, that person's sick. And because they're sick, they can't work. And because they can't work, they can't acquire food and the things that they need in order to sustain their life. This was something that Siddhartha Gautama had never understood before, because he had everything he needed in the palace. And he didn't understand that life of not having what you need. So this had a big impact on him. Then he saw an aging person, someone who was getting older in age and their bones were protruding and having difficulty working and walking and doing the things that you need to do. And he saw this disgruntledness around this person. And he had to ask his royal attendant, you know, what's going on over there? And his royal attendant explained to him that, okay, this person's old, they're getting old and decrepit, they're not able to function in the world so easily, and they're not able to get the resources that they need to sustain their life. And then he saw a dead body, and he saw the people grieving and being miserable about this person who had died. And he had to ask what that was, because he didn't even realize at the age of 29 that this life is going to come to an end and we die. And he had to ask his royal attendant what was going on. And they explained to him that these people had this family member, that they died, that this person's grieving, and now this is the way that they're experiencing that death. And Siddhartha Gautama starts to come to realize that the kingdom is full of misery and grief, because this isn't the life that he's living in the royal palace. In the royal palace, he's living a very different life than what's going on out in the kingdom. So he starts comparing this and seeing that life in the kingdom is very miserable, and there's lots of misery and disgruntledness and irritation and frustration in the kingdom. And then he has the fourth observation, which he sees a roaming aesthetic, or what we would probably refer to as a monk, someone who's given up worldly possessions and going on this journey to try to figure out how to get to enlightenment. And he has to ask his royal attendant, what's going on over there? What is that person doing? And he says, oh, that's somebody who's trying to figure out all these problems of sickness, aging, and death. And Siddhartha Gautama says, this is what he would like to do. He decides in this moment that this is what he would like to do, is go on this journey to figure out why all these things are happening in the kingdom and how to help people escape that. He's not interested in being a king and ruling over this misery. He would like to help people escape all of this. So when he goes back to the palace, he actually has a wife and a young son at this point. He has an infant son. And when he goes back to the palace, they're sleeping. And he decides that he's going to leave in the middle of the night. He didn't understand his mind 100% and how the unenlightened mind works, but he understood it enough that he felt like if he said goodbye, or he kissed them goodbye, or hugged them, or waked them up, that he would have difficulties leaving and he wouldn't be able to leave. So he just kind of leaves in the middle of the night. And he takes with him his horse, and he takes his royal attendant with him. And when he leaves, he goes off on this journey, and he ultimately gets to this point where he sends his royal attendant off, and he says goodbye, and he lets his horse go as well, because he was holding on to these things and he decides to let them go. And he has this long flowing hair. At this time, the royal family would grow their hair very, very long. And this is the way that people knew that you were part of the royal family. So if you went out into the kingdom and you had this long, beautiful flowing hair, they knew you were part of the royal family. Because people that were working in the fields and business owners and shopkeepers, we wouldn't be able to maintain that long, beautiful hair because we don't have the time. We're too busy doing this laborious work. It's only the royal family that could sit around and have people combing their hair, detangling their hair, shampooing their hair. They would be the only ones that could maintain this long, beautiful, flowing hair. So Siddhartha Gautama ends up cutting off his hair after growing it for 29 years. And this is essentially a way of saying, I'm never going back. Because nobody would ever believe that he was the king going out into the kingdom without this long, beautiful, flowing hair. Today, we just take photos and we put them all over the kingdom to show people who the king and the queen are. But back then, they didn't have this ability. So that's why they had this long, beautiful, flowing hair. And also cutting off your hair, you're going to hear in our retreat that this is a way to help you do what's called realizing non-self. You don't need to cut off your hair in order to get to enlightenment, but this is one step that some people choose to take in order to help bring one of the particular teachings that you need into your life and train the mind in a certain way. But I'll explain that to you when we get to that during our retreat. So he cuts off his hair so that he's never going back to the royal palace, but it also helps him to realize non-self, which is what you're going to learn about in this retreat as part of the classes that I share. Well, he ends up going to take up training with two different teachers. And the first teacher he studies with for 1 year. And this teacher teaches him to hang himself upside down from trees, to lay on beds of nails, to pierce his body with metal implements, to starve himself. Essentially, the idea was if you could create physical pain for the body and your mind could overcome that, that you would be able to get to enlightenment. And he studies for an entire year. And this teacher declares him to be a master of his teachings and says, hey, you can teach my teachings. Go ahead. You've mastered what it is that I have to share. And Siddhartha Gautama realized that his mind wasn't any more peaceful than it was before when he was in the palace. So this teacher, although this teacher was claiming that his teachings led to enlightenment, Siddhartha Gautama realized that they didn't because he had mastered those teachings and his mind wasn't enlightened. So he goes and studies with another teacher for an entire year. Same thing occurs, teaching him to hang himself upside down from trees and starving himself and doing some different things, but essentially the same things. And this teacher realizes that he's mastered his teachings after about a year. And Siddhartha Gautama realized his mind was still discontent. He was still experiencing frustration and irritation and annoyance and all these other things. So he decides to go off on his own. He's frustrated and from wasting these 2 years of his life, he goes off on his own in the forest and tries to get to enlightenment. And when he first enters into the forest, he really doesn't know much other than what these teachers had taught him. So he continues to do these things. He's continuing to starve himself and do all these kinds of things. And he takes it so far that he ends up eating just 1 grain of rice per day. That's how far he took it. And his bones were protruding, his ribs were protruding, his facial bones were protruding, his weight had completely deteriorated. He was essentially on death's doorstep. And there was the mother and a young daughter who comes by and they see him meditating and he appears to be having malnutrition and he's not really well taken care of and he's about to die. And this mother and this young daughter plead with him to start eating and they offer him a bowl of rice. He reluctantly accepts this bowl of rice, but he realizes in that moment something very key to his training. He realizes what's called the middle way, where when he was in the palace, he had all these sensual pleasures. He had all the food, all the clothing, all the entertainment, and everything you could ever imagine. But when he left the palace, he swung all the way over to the other side, where he was now disparaging the body, just eating 1 grain of rice per day. And he realizes these two extremes doesn't take the mind to the enlightened mental state. So he starts forging this middle way, is what it's called, where he starts eating in moderation. He starts eating one meal a day. You don't need to eat one meal a day in order to get to enlightenment, but you need to learn to eat in moderation. We'll be talking about that as we go in our retreat. But nonetheless, he starts to discover this middle way, that if your life is out of balance, that your mind can't be peaceful and joyful. And he ultimately ends up relating it to a musical instrument when he starts teaching, that if you've ever played a stringed instrument or you've ever been around a musical instrument, if the string is too tight and you pluck it, the instrument doesn't play the way it was intended to play. It doesn't play beautiful music. But if the string is too loose and you pluck that, it doesn't play beautiful music that way either. It doesn't play the way the instrument was intended to play. So he notices that the mind is the same way, that if the mind's too tight or it's too loose, that it doesn't play beautiful music the way that it was intended to play. The mind doesn't perform optimally the way that it's intended to perform. You lack concentration and focus and clarity of mind when the mind is polluted with certain pollutions. So he ultimately discovers what's causing the mind to be discontent. He discovers these 10 individual pollutions, which we're going to be talking about tomorrow. They're called the 10 fetters. These 10 pollutions are what's plaguing the mind and keeping it in the unenlightened state. We call it a fetter because it's like a shackle and a chain and a ball. This is what they refer to as a fetter that keeps a prisoner trapped in a certain location. During ancient times, this is how they kept prisoners in one location. So these 10 pollutions or these 10 fetters are keeping the mind in the unenlightened state. So he discovers what these are, and he discovers the tools and techniques of how to eradicate these from the mind. So over the next 4-year period, a total of 6 years, he discovers what it takes to get to enlightenment, and his mind's peaceful, calm, serene, and content with joy. He doesn't experience any more anger, frustration, or any other discontent feelings. But having done this, by the age of 35, he realizes that he's a Buddha. He's essentially going to become a Buddha. Because what a Buddha is a Buddha is someone who's discovered the teachings by themselves without the help of any teachers or any guides. Then they dedicate the rest of their life to sharing those independently discovered teachings with countless people, and countless people get to enlightenment during their lifetime. And then they preserve their teachings in such a way that countless more people get to enlightenment after their death. So these are the three main criteria of what make a Buddha, is they get to enlightenment by themselves, they share those independently discovered teachings with countless people, and then people get to enlightenment during their lifetime, countless people, because they have deep, profound wisdom of what it takes to get to enlightenment. And then a Buddha is going to preserve their teachings so that other people can get to enlightenment after their death. So Siddhartha Gautama, having realized that he got to enlightenment by himself, he knows that he's potentially going to become a Buddha. So he goes to this tree and he contemplates for 7 weeks of whether or not he should actually go share his teachings or not, because he realized that his teachings were vastly different than what anyone else was teaching at the time. Because remember, people are hanging themselves upside down from trees, they're starving themselves, they're doing all these disparaging things to the body, causing pain, thinking that if they overcome that with their mind, they will get to enlightenment. So after 7 weeks of hanging out of this tree, he ultimately decides he's going to share his teachings. And he goes back to the area where those initial teachers were teaching him. And he runs into 4 of his previous classmates and 1 of his previous teachers. And these people started mocking him, and they start joking him, and they laughing at him, because they see that he has meat on his bones. To them, in order to get to enlightenment, you need to starve yourself. And when they saw that he had meat on his bones, they thought that he had given up on the path to enlightenment. So they start mocking him and joking him. But by the time you get to enlightenment, if people are being disrespectful and mocking you and joking you like that, you don't have any discontent feelings whatsoever. You're not going to experience irritation or annoyance or frustration or anything like that. So the Buddha, he was just calm and peaceful. He knew he had gotten to enlightenment. These people are mocking him and joking him. So he walks over, he sits down, and then he takes his hand and he touches the earth. And he performs a miracle. This is the one and only miracle that he ever performs. Some of the depictions of the Buddha in statue form show this, where the Buddha is sitting and he's touching the ground. And what he does when he touches the ground is he calls these animals to come to where he's at. You'll see sometimes they'll depict deer and rabbits and squirrels and lizards and birds and all these animals coming. And this is a miracle for those first 5 students to show that, yes, I've attained enlightenment. And when these first 5 students see this miracle, they sit down and they listen to what he has to say. And he shares his very first teaching. It's called the Four Noble Truths. I'm going to share this with you tomorrow, first thing in the morning tomorrow. The Four Noble Truths, you understand the problem in the unenlightened mind, the cause, the elimination, and the path forward. In 4 simple statements, the Buddha explains to you why your mind experiences things like anger, sadness, frustration, and all those discontent feelings, the stress, the anxiety, because in order to eliminate those feelings, you need to understand what's causing them. So you can have this real breakthrough where you finally understand what's causing these discontent feelings. Because typically in the unenlightened state, the mind will blame other people and think that it's other people that are causing you to be angry. But you can actually see through these 4 statements and independently verify that your mind is causing these feelings itself. So after learning those 4 noble truths, those first 5 students, they could independently verify that he had attained enlightenment. They knew, because he could describe what the problem is, what the cause is, how to eliminate it, and what the entire path is. So he was able to articulate that. And now those first five students start to train and develop their mind, and ultimately they get to enlightenment during the lifetime of the Buddha. From that point forward, the Buddha continues to teach, but he doesn't perform any more miracles. The Buddha's ability to share their teachings and help people get to enlightenment isn't dependent on people knowing that they're a Buddha. So a Buddha doesn't go around performing miracles to try to convince more and more people that they're a Buddha. It's actually helpful if people don't know who a Buddha is, because if people don't know who the Buddha is, the Buddha can see their natural mind. They can see when they're angry, when they're frustrated, when they're irritated. Whereas if everybody knew who a Buddha was, they might be on their best behavior when they're around this person, and you wouldn't be able to see their natural mind. So one of the real powers of a Buddha is that nobody knows who the Buddha is, and he's able to share his teachings and be able to observe the quality of mind of his students. So it's not like there's a, you know, ear that's turned or a nose that's turned or a certain mark on the forehead that proves that this person's a Buddha. He knew he was a Buddha, and that's all that's important, because then the students, when they're learning and practicing the teachings, they can independently verify that they're true. And this is how you know that someone's gotten to enlightenment, is that you can independently verify their teachings. And as you learn and practice them, you see the condition of your mind gradually improving. So he ends up sharing his teachings for 45 years, from the age of 35 to 80. He ends up spending time with his wife, with his son, with his mother, his cousins and brother-in-laws. People are coming out of the royal family to join him. And his son ends up getting to enlightenment, his wife, his stepmother, his aunt, his brother-in-laws and cousins, all the way to the point where his dad has to beg and plead with him to stop ordaining people from the royal family, because his father didn't want this royal family to fall apart. And he pleaded with the Buddha to stop having the royal family come and be students with them. And the Buddha wasn't asking them to come study with them. They were choosing to do that themselves. So the Buddha instituted guidance that is still in place today, that if you would like to become ordained, you need to have your family support, that they need to support you and agree that yes, you can go off and do this, because it puts more of a burden on your family members if you're leaving out of the household. So this is something that the Buddha instituted during his lifetime. But for 45 years, his community keeps growing, and more and more people start to realize that he's enlightened and he's a Buddha. And he dies at the age of 80. And he just dies of old age, essentially. And once he dies, then his teachings continue from there. During his lifetime, everything that he taught was oral. It was an oral tradition. But then not too long after he died, people started writing down the teachings. The technology to write the teachings down didn't exist in that region of the world where he was at. It existed in China, but it hadn't made its way to that region of the world yet. So the language that he was speaking, it was only an oral tradition. It was only an oral language. They didn't even have a script at that time. They had to invent a script in order to actually write it down. But they did end up writing it down. But this is where chanting came along, that during the lifetime of the Buddha, when he would teach orally, his students would remember what he taught. And then every 2 weeks, they would come together and they would chant his teachings. They would recite them word for word for word in order to commit them to memory and then to be able to practice them in daily life. Nowadays, we have books, we have videos, we have podcasts, we have different ways of capturing the teachings. We have audiobooks and things like this. So we don't need to chant in order to remember the teachings. But you'll see that I'll introduce you to chanting, because it helps ease the mind into meditation and actually get more benefit out of the meditation itself. But we don't need it for the memorization of the teachings. The chanting, these aren't rites or rituals or ceremonies or worship. It's not prayer or anything like that. But we chant in order to ease the mind into meditation. But it started during the lifetime of the Buddha as a way to remember the teachings. So he teaches this long teaching career, many people get to enlightenment, then they document his teachings and many more people get to enlightenment after his death. Even today, there's people that are enlightened based on the teachings of the Buddha. But it was the sickness, aging, and death that really motivated him to be able to make his way to enlightenment and go on this journey, because he saw this discontentedness. And what he discovers, which you're going to hear tomorrow when I talk about the Four Noble Truths, is he discovers what's called craving, desire, attachment, wants and expectations, the longing, the yearning, craving for things to be permanent. That as long as your mind is craving permanent health, when you experience change or impermanence, when you're sick, the mind doesn't like that. when the body is sick, the mind's craving permanent health. And now when you're sick, you're going to be discontent. You're going to be angry or frustrated because the mind's craving permanence, when in reality, this body is impermanent. Or if you're aging, you might crave permanent youthfulness. So when you see a little bit of gray hair or wrinkle, or a little bit extra fat, or you start having difficulties and aches and pains, the mind can be discontent during this time because it's craving permanent youthfulness. Or if you're craving permanent life, now when you're getting closer to death and you're holding on to this world, you might really struggle with death. Or you might struggle from the death of other people, that when you're grandparents or your parents or your brothers and sisters and friends are dying, you might be craving or longing and yearning for them to be permanent. And now you experience sadness or grief when they die. Oftentimes people think it's love that's causing the sadness or the grief, but love is a genuine interest in seeing beings be well. It's an active goodwill. That doesn't actually cause a mind to be sad or feeling grief or misery or despair, anything like that. What's causing those discontent feelings is the craving, the desire, the wanting things to be permanent. And the Buddha discovers this, and this is ultimately what motivated him to go on this journey. And then in addition to that, he discovers this cycle of rebirth, that beings are continually being reborn over and over and over again. And the way that he figures this out is that he observes his past lives, that he, as he lifts the pollution out of the mind, he starts to be able to observe his past lives prior to his current life. And this is something that you can actually independently verify as well. The cycle of rebirth isn't something to believe in, but you can learn it, you can reflect on it, and you can see the truth that it's actually true, that this is what's truly occurring. But that's not something you usually start with right from the beginning. So the Buddha shares how to escape this discontentedness, where the mind is no longer sad or angry or frustrated or those other discontent feelings. And he also explains how to escape this cycle of rebirth, where one is continually being reborn over and over and over again. So this is a bit about the life story of the Buddha. What I'm going to do here is just pause and see if you guys have any questions about anything that I've shared about the life story of the Buddha before we go into talking about the retreat itself. Again, here I was just interested in giving you a bit of information to understand his life story so that you would understand the teachings that you're going to be learning this week and throughout your journey to enlightenment of where they come from. And this is why we refer to him as Gautama Buddha, because his name was Siddhartha Gautama. And some people refer to him as the Buddha, or there's other terms that refer to him in different cultures. So you might hear different people referring to him in different ways, or even spelling his name in different ways as well. So do you guys have any questions here at the temple, or anybody online? Do you guys have questions about the life story of the Buddha? No questions? Okay, let me see what we got. Do we have anything here online? Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. All right, so the thing that I'll share to just kind of wrap this up about the life story of the Buddha is that no one ever said life would be easy, but it's also not supposed to be tough either. In the unenlightened state, life can sometimes feel kind of tough, depending on what challenges that you're experiencing and what you're facing, what your relationships are like. It can feel quite tough. But when you're learning the teachings of the Buddha, while it's not easy to learn and practice his teachings, it'll ensure that life is not tough, that by the time you get to enlightenment, life is at ease. Your mind is peaceful. Your mind is joyful. Right now, there might be certain decisions that you're getting ready to make or that you're in the process of making that you might be struggling through. This is just because the mind lacks wisdom. It's not because you're a bad person. You're not being punished. You're not being rewarded or anything like this. It's just that the mind lacks certain wisdom. And when you gain wisdom about these natural laws, which isn't easy, it's a challenge. It's also not difficult either. It's just a challenge to learn and practice and transform your mind and change your perspective about how you interact in the world based on the way you were brought up or the way that you've grown up. So as you're learning and practicing the teachings, you can get to a point where life is no longer tough. That by the time you get to enlightenment, all your relationships are at ease. Any decisions that you need to make, anything that you're being confronted with, you can address that very simply and very easily. There isn't anything that's difficult anymore in your life because you've done that hard work of doing the inner work to transform the mind and learn these natural laws. And now when you're going about your day-to-day life, things are quite easy and quite straightforward because you can navigate this world through these natural laws, as I was describing. Just like now, you no longer struggle with the natural law of gravity, where at one time you struggled with it. Right now, you might be struggling with the natural laws of existence. If you don't know what those are, your mind's going to experience a sadness and anger and frustration and all those other discontent feelings. But once you overcome that hurdle and that obstacle to understanding these natural laws, you won't experience the struggles and difficulties anymore. So while life can seem difficult and tough at certain times, it doesn't have to be. When you cultivate wisdom, your life can be at ease because everything you experience is based on the mind. You experience everything through the mind. So if you can train your mind and purify your mind, anything you experience, you can just approach it with ease. And that's what you can ultimately get to. So this is a bit of the story of the Buddha. But now let's move into talking about this retreat and kind of how this retreat is formed. First, let's talk about the benefits of getting to the first stage of enlightenment. This is actually directly from the Buddha. The first six of these are directly from the Buddha, his actual words. He says, by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, and I agree with what he's sharing here, is that one is fixed in the wholesome teachings. By the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you will know what the teachings are to be able to get to enlightenment. You're not fully practicing them yet, but you at least know what they are, meaning you'll know that these teachings are leading to an improved condition of mind. Up until the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you're probably going to have certain doubts about whether this person, the Buddha, actually lived, whether the teachings can help you to improve the condition of your mind or not. But by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you will have eradicated any doubt about the teachings. You will be fixed in the wholesome teachings, knowing that you've experienced a certain amount of improvement because you've seen your mind go from situations where you were once angry or frustrated and irritated. Those same situations can be occurring after you've been training your mind for a period of time, and you will no longer experience the anger, the frustration, or any other discontent feelings based on that situation. But in the first stage of enlightenment, you're still experiencing discontentedness, but you'll notice some of the situations where you once experienced discontentedness, you will no longer be experiencing discontentedness in those specific situations. So you'll know that these teachings are leading to an improved condition of your mind and an improved condition of your life. But there's more work for you to be able to do to get to enlightenment. There's four stages of enlightenment that I'm going to talk about tomorrow. But by the time you get to the first stage, you will know that these teachings are leading to an improved condition of your life and through the condition of the mind. One is incapable of decline. What the Buddha is talking about here is that once you get to the first stage of enlightenment, that your mind can't regress backwards from there. It's not possible. But up until the point where before you get to the first stage of enlightenment, any work that you're doing, if you become complacent, for example, your mind can regress and go backwards, where you're not experiencing as much concentration, or you're not experiencing as much mindfulness or awareness of mind. This is where if you've been learning teachings for a certain period of time and you feel like your mind is awakened to a certain degree, you might have kind of gotten complacent, gone away from the teachings for a while, and you might have noticed that your mind regressed backwards. But by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, that's not actually possible. Your mind will reside in that first stage of enlightenment and it won't regress backwards. And this is one of the reasons why the first stage of enlightenment is so important to be able to acquire and attain that stage of enlightenment, because your mind won't regress. It's impossible. The third thing is that one's discontentedness is limited. What the Buddha is describing here is that by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, the discontentedness that you once experienced when you were off the path to enlightenment, or even when you first got onto the path to enlightenment, what you're experiencing now in the first stage of enlightenment, it's a mere fraction of what you once experienced. This is where you'll notice that the contentedness and the joy in your mind is starting to arise more and more. So before, where you might have swung from the happiness and excitement, you might have swung over to the anger and the frustration at different times. Now that's more muted. The mind's coming more into the middle, where you don't experience those significant discontent experiences anymore, that the mind isn't shaken up so much, that it's just a mere fraction of what you once experienced. One comes to possess wisdom not shared by others. When you're learning the path to enlightenment and the natural laws of existence, there's going to be certain things that you understand that the people around you just don't understand. And this isn't a judgmental thing. This shouldn't produce any ego in your mind that you think you're better than anybody else. But you just need to come to the understanding that as you interact with people, things that are going to become so easy and straightforward and that are so obvious to you, they're not obvious to other people. And you can be interacting with people that are blaming you for their anger or blaming you for their frustration. And you know that you didn't cause their mind to be upset and angry, but yet they firmly believe that it's you that's causing them to be upset. And you'll know that that's not the truth. And there's going to be other things that you know that other people just don't know. And it's important for you to know this because when you go out in the world and you're interacting with people, if you go out into the world assuming that they know the same things that you know, it can leave you kind of confused. So understanding that you're going to be understanding certain things that other people just don't understand, not as an egotistical or arrogant thing, but you'll just have this wisdom that others won't have, and you're going to need to understand that and reflect on that and adjust perhaps what you're talking about and you're discussing with people so that you can take that into consideration as you're having conversations. And this will become more and more apparent as you're learning what I have to share with you this week. The number five is one has clearly seen causation. What the Buddha is talking about here is the natural law of karma, of cause and effect, or action and result. What some people refer to this natural law, they refer to it as karma. This is the Sanskrit version of that word. The original teachings of the Buddha are in the Pali language, so I use the word karma. If this translated to just one English word, I would just use that English word because it'd be much easier to use it, but there's doesn't translate to just one English word, so we need to use multiple words to explain it. What the natural law of karma is, this is the main natural law that you're awakening to, is its cause and effect, or action and result. It's the results of your decisions. It's not punishments. It's not rewards. It's not mystical or magical. There's no being or entity that's controlling this and trying to figure out who gets punished and who gets rewarded. It's not even about who's at blame or who's at fault. It's just a sequence of events of showing if you make this decision, it leads to these things, or this action leads to this result. This is causality, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. So you've been experiencing this natural law all throughout your life, just like the natural law of gravity, that you were affected by this natural law of gravity, whether you're aware of it or not. The natural law of karma, you're affected by this natural law, whether you're aware of it or not. And the more you're aware of it, the more you understand it, then you'll make wise decisions that lead to wholesome results. So by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you will have seen this causality. You won't fully understand it 100% yet until you're actually enlightened, but you'll at least have developed an understanding of it to a certain degree to be able to get to this first stage of enlightenment. And that's what the Buddha is sharing here. Number six, one has clearly seen causally arisen objects. What he's referring to here is dependent origination. And this is a teaching that we're going to be talking about in this class, in this retreat. This is the highest, most ultimate truth of the Buddha, where he's explaining to you exactly why you experience discontentedness in 12 interlinking steps. And the same teaching also explains to you why you experience rebirth. So you can actually independently verify these 12 interlinking steps of why your mind is getting to the point where it experiences discontentedness and why you're experiencing rebirth. In the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha kind of gives you a window into dependent origination where he kind of boils it down to four simple statements. But dependent origination is like showing your work. If you ever had a math teacher that was like, okay, you've got the answer, but show me the work, right? This is where the Buddha is showing you the work in dependent origination. So you will have clearly seen these causally arisen objects, understanding what's causing the mind to be in the unenlightened state. And then by understanding what's causing the mind to be in the unenlightened state, you can actually fix it and resolve it. Because when you understand the problem and the cause of that problem, then you can understand the solution and how to implement that solution. But if you don't understand the problem, these causally arisen objects, you won't understand how to solve the problem. So these are all from the Buddha. And then I added this seventh one in just for me to help you understand one of the benefits of attaining the first stage of enlightenment is that you have everything you need to make your way to the fourth stage of enlightenment, where the mind is actually enlightened. One of the ways that I think about the first stage of enlightenment is that if you were going to climb Mount Everest, you would have to do a whole lot of work just to get to base camp. If you were going to climb Mount Everest, you're going to need to go out hiking. You're going to need to figure out about equipment and boots and clothes and tents and food. And you're going to learn about the atmosphere. You're going to learn about hiking techniques and backpacks and all these different equipment and tools and techniques that you're going to need just to get to base camp. And now when you're at base camp, you have all the wisdom and all the tools and all the equipment you need to get to the summit, but you just haven't made it to the summit yet. So by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you've acquired all the teachings that you need in order to get to enlightenment, but you haven't gotten to enlightenment yet. There's still more work to do. The same thing as when you get to the base camp, Mount Everest, there's still more work to do, but you have all the wisdom that you need to potentially get to this summit of Mount Everest. So the same thing is true with the first stage of enlightenment, that you will have developed all the wisdom that you need to then be able to make your way to enlightenment. So this retreat, there's a lot of information here in this 5 days that we're going to be sharing with you. You're not going to master everything that I have to share with you in these 5 days, but you'll have been at least exposed to it. And you'll start implementing potentially some of the teachings that are being shared and start seeing the results. But then you might need to learn in this retreat more than one time. In fact, there's people here online that were in this retreat last time I taught it in August, and they're leading to learn again, right? Because you can't absorb 100% of everything in just 1 5-day event. So you're going to need to revisit these teachings multiple times. So by the time you fully develop your understanding of these teachings that I'm sharing with you in this retreat, you will get to base camp. You will get to the first stage of enlightenment over a period of time. And everybody takes a different amount of time. It depends on your determination, your dedication, your diligence. It determined based on how much pollution you currently have in your mind and how much effort you put into learning and practicing. You're definitely not going to be at the first stage of enlightenment at the end of this retreat, but you'll be making steps in that direction and have been exposed to all the things that you need to be able to get to that first stage of enlightenment. So these are the benefits of getting to the first stage of enlightenment. So now I'm going to talk to you a bit about the retreat schedule and plan and kind of have an open discussion about what it is we're going to be doing over the next 5 days together. So the way that I think about a retreat, the way that I think about a learning event, is I think about this staircase, that a student is basically potentially at the bottom of the staircase, and now they're needing to walk up this staircase. And what a teacher is doing is we're showing you where the staircase is, we're showing you where the stairs are, we're helping you learn how to walk up this staircase. But it's you that needs to do the work to walk up this staircase. So as I was mentioning before, it's your own independent journey to make your way up this staircase, where a teacher is helping you along the way. A teacher would have potentially already been up this staircase, and now they're coming down to help you and show you how to make your way up this staircase. So if you keep that image in mind, that as you go throughout the retreat, that you're on your own independent journey to learning and developing, then you're in the driver's seat. You're the one asking questions. You're the one reading books, perhaps. You're the one that's asking certain questions in various conversations, either during class or outside of class, that you're the one who's on your own independent journey to walk up this staircase. The things that I'm going to be doing as I'm helping you to walk up this staircase is that each morning we're going to get together starting at 9 a.m. We're going to start with meditation, that I'll guide you guys in a certain meditation. You're going to learn 3 meditations in this retreat: breathing mindfulness meditation, loving kindness meditation, and the meditation to realize non-self. I'm going to teach those to you, and I'm going to guide you in doing them, and you're going to get practice throughout the retreat as you're doing meditation each morning, if you'd like to join for that. Then around 9:30, we're going to start with a certain teachings or certain discussion. I don't think about the teachings that I share. I don't think of them as lectures or sermons or things like this. I think of it as a discussion, that I'm sharing teachings with you and then opening up to any questions that you might have related to those teachings. And then it's up to you to learn, reflect, and practice to be able to see the truth in those teachings. So we'll do that between 9:30 and 12:30, and we'll be taking a break in there. I'll usually take 15-20 minute breaks so that you guys can use the restroom. You can get some snacks. You can talk with each other. You can meet out here outside the class. There's some tables to relax. You can relax in here. You can go for a walk. You can spend time getting to know each other. This is one of the benefits of coming to an event like this. You meet people that are into wholesome things and that are interested in improving their life. So you'll get a chance to take breaks, and then we'll have some more discussion up until lunch. And we'll generally take lunch around 12:30, maybe sometimes a little bit earlier, maybe sometimes a little bit later, but we'll generally be breaking at 12:30. And then from 12:30 on, there's free time where you can go get lunch, you can go to the park, you can go do shopping or whatever it is that you would like to do. I have organized some excursions if you guys would like to participate in. You can come along to those excursions. I'll share with you guys what those are so you know what they are. And you can join if you like or not. You can stay here. You can do whatever you would like to do. But then during this period of time when we're doing the excursions, you can also not only have lunch and go on the excursion, but you can also have dinner and any kind of free time. And then we finish that part back at 6:30 where we get together. So there's going to be these four different excursions that I'll share with you that are actually five different excursions that we'll be able to invite you guys to participate in if you'd like to. And I'll explain to you guys what those are here. What we're going to do today, if you guys would like, is there's this market right outside that it's being set up right now. If you haven't been to the Sunday night walking market, or you'd like to walk around and talk with each other and get a little bit of food, maybe get a smoothie, get something to eat. Maybe you're interested in getting a foot massage or something like that. We can all go out to the market and walk together. But not everybody has to do the same thing, right? If some people decide to go home, okay, wonderful. Go enjoy your time at home. But if some people would like to go walk around in the market, we can do that. On Monday, I organized to go to Sangapeng, to the hot springs, where we can sit around in the hot springs, we can talk, get to know each other, enjoy the bathing in the hot springs. You might decide to bring a bathing suit if you'd like to go here, or not. You can just bathe in the little trough that they have going through the park. Then on Tuesday, if you'd like to go to the elephant sanctuary, I've organized a outing to this elephant sanctuary that is normally 1600 baht to go. They've given us a special price of only 800 baht to be able to go. And what they have set up is they have a place where there's no rides, there's no things like that. They're not working the elephants. It's just to take care of the elephants. And what they do is they educate us. When we go there, they're going to come pick us up in a van. They'll take us there. They actually give us a set of clothes that we change into clothes so that we don't mess up the clothes that we're in. We make medicine for the elephants, and they give us food, and we feed the elephants. We give them medicine. We take them over to a lake and to a river, and we bathe them. We take care of them. You can even jump in the river with them if you like and play around with them and bathe them and take care of them. And there's a tour guide there that is teaching us about the life of an elephant and the health of an elephant and what they do with that sanctuary. And then ultimately we will get back here in time for our evening talk, because they have showers over there that you can take a shower and you can change back into your normal clothes. So if you'd like to go to that, I will probably check in with you guys tomorrow morning to see who's planning to go, because I need to call them and so they can make arrangements and come pick us up. So if you'd like to go to that, we'll probably eat lunch around here, and then they'll pick us up around 1:30 and take us over there and then bring us back, and we'll get dinner at some point along the way, and then we'll be here for the 6:30 talk. Then if you'd like to go on Wednesday to this children's orphanage, there's a children's orphanage that I visit occasionally in order to help them with food and clothing and different things that they need. Typically what we do is we gather up, we go have lunch somewhere, we get into a van, we go to the store, we buy a bunch of food like rice and vegetables and different things that they're going to need at the orphanage, and then we take it to the orphanage, and then the person who runs the orphanage is there to teach us about the orphanage, and we donate these things to them, and then the children eventually come along, they get out of school and they come along, and you get to meet the children. And this particular orphanage, they started out very early, and now they've been around for about 17, 18 years. They've just recently moved into a new facility, and I haven't been to their new facility yet. In this orphanage, the children started out very young, but now they're kind of older. I think the youngest one is maybe 12 or 13 years old. And this orphanage doesn't really get much support. Most of the orphanages that get support are the ones that have the really young kids, right? Because everybody would like to go spend time with the three-year-olds, the six-year-olds, and their heart is really pulling. And I understand that. But I tend to support places where other people don't support because I know those other places are getting lots of support. So I tend to find places where they're not really getting that much support. So this particular orphanage doesn't really get that much support. So we go there, and if you would like to go, you'll learn about an orphanage and be able to see where they live and how they live, and the children are there. They tend to be a little bit shy. They don't really talk much, but if you'd like to talk to them and learn about what their life is like, they'll be able to share with you. A lot of the children that are there, their parents are either dead or they've been involved in drugs and things like this, and their parents might be in prison. And now they're living at this orphanage to be able to get care and be taken care of while their parents are away in prison or in jail. So if you'd like to go to that, we get together. And if you're not interested in going to that, you can even contribute to the funds that we use in order to give food to them, because we'll take that money and we'll go buy some food at the markets and then we'll take it to them. So you can even contribute to that, even if you're choosing not to go. And then on Thursday, our last excursion is to Hua Tung Tao. If you guys know about this place, it's a lake, it's a reservoir. They have bungalows all the way around the lake and the reservoir. It's a national park, essentially. It's run by the government. They have really good food, really good tasting food. You can go swimming. You can go walking on nature trails. They have zip lining over there. You can just ride bicycles. You can go on a walk. We can just sit and talk and spend more time with each other. So it's a really nice, relaxed environment to be able to spend time with each other. So if you'd like to go to any of these events, what I'm going to be doing is each morning when we take our first break, I'll kind of check in with you guys before we take our first break to find out who would like to go, so that then from around about 10:30 or so, I can start organizing transportation, because we're going to need to have vans or trucks or something to come take us to these different events. And you guys can just contribute and share. It ends up being about 200 to 300 baht per person for the transportation. Where the event with the elephant sanctuary, that is included in that 800 baht that they're giving us, that great deal that you don't have to pay any transportation outside of that. But all these others will need to pay for transportation, except for the Sunday night walking market, which is just right outside of our temple here. So I'll check in with you guys at the first break to see who would like to go to any of these excursions. And you can decide at that point if you'd like to go or not. And then at 6:30 in the evening, I'm going to start with meditation, and then by 7, I'll have another talk where I'll be teaching you the teachings of the Buddha, and you guys can ask any and all questions that you like, and then we'll be finishing up around 8:30. You're going to see some people are just going to come for the evening classes because they're working or they're not able to come for the morning, so they might just be here for the evening classes, and you guys are welcome to come and go as you like to any of these different events. There's no requirements of what you have to do or what you're not required to do or anything like that. It's up to you. It's your choices and your decisions. And this is the event that is here for you to be able to learn in terms of the schedule and the plan. We'll finish on Friday right around 5 o'clock. Last time we actually finished quite a bit earlier. I think we finished around 4 on our last retreat. So what I do in the very last thing in the retreat is I have kind of a closing discussion to see if there's any remaining questions that you guys might have. So depending on where you guys are by the end of the retreat, we might finish somewhere around 5 o'clock or maybe even a little bit earlier. Keep in mind that this retreat is impermanent and our time together is impermanent. You guys are going to make relationships and spend time together. And sometimes I've gotten to the end of a retreat and people are crying. They're upset because they've had so much fun and so much of a good time with each other. So just always keep in mind that as you're enjoying that time with your friends and your new friends this week, that it's impermanent, that eventually this retreat will be over, right? And we'll move on and do other things. So if you'd like to know the different schedule of the different talks and the different topics that I'm going to be talking about, perhaps you guys have already seen this if you're here. But if not, you might decide to bookmark this because you'll see the entire schedule, exactly what time I'm going to be teaching the various topics, even a description of what the various talks are. So you can get all the access to the entire retreat schedule and plan by going to this particular link. These are the topics that I'm going to be teaching you starting tomorrow. I'm going to be teaching you breathing mindfulness meditation in the seated position. I'm going to teach you that, and then we're going to do it together. Then I'm going to teach you what is enlightenment, because you need to know what this enlightened mental state is. If you're going to navigate your way to it, you need to know what it is. It's just like if you're going from Chiang Mai to Chiang Rai, you would need to know, like, what is Chiang Rai? What is it like? Am I even interested in going to that place? So that way you can more readily navigate your way to it. And then once you arrive, you'll know that you've arrived. So by understanding what enlightenment is, you'll be able to more easily navigate your way to it. And you'll know when your mind is actually enlightened by understanding what it is. Then I'm going to share that very first teaching of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths. This is where you can establish right view and you can understand the problem, the cause, the elimination, and the path forward. And then I'll also share with you in the afternoon, or actually the evening, the three poisons, or the craving, anger, and ignorance. This is that 6:30 talk that I'll start at 6:30 with some meditation, but then I'm going to share this particular topic with you, where the Four Noble Truths gives you a window into the unenlightened mind. The three poisons gives you a broader and a deeper understanding of what the real problems are in the unenlightened mind. So that'll really help you to be able to understand what the problems are, but also what the solutions are. I'm going to explain to you the solutions to this. Then this yoga, actually, this is something that my wife will usually come in and teach, but she told me that she has too much going on. She can't do it for this particular retreat, but I left it on the schedule because if you guys would like to come in and do some stretching or yoga or something like this, you guys can do that. I usually get here at 8:00 in the morning, but if you guys would like to come early and use this space for any reason, let me know. I'll give you the combination to the door and you guys can just make your way in and you can use the space for yourself. So that's why I left it in there. But sometimes if you come to this retreat, you might see my wife here who will teach yoga in the morning to be able to help you guys. Because being on the floor like this, or even if you decide to use a chair, you know, you're sitting in one spot. So kind of doing some stretching and this can really help the body to be more comfortable throughout the retreat. So feel free to do that kind of stuff if you'd like. And if you need this space to do that, let me know. Then we're going to start our Tuesday morning with walking meditation. I'm going to teach you how to do walking meditation, which is really helpful if your mind is overactive or uptight or having lots of energy. You can do walking meditation to kind of get out some of the energy. Then I'm going to teach you the core central teaching of the Buddha, which is called the Eightfold Path. This is the path for all humans to enlightenment. All the other teachings plug into this. If you're interested in getting to enlightenment based on the teachings of the Buddha, you would need to know the Eightfold Path. So I'm going to use the words of the Buddha to walk you through this step by step by step and helping you to understand this. Then in the evening, I'm going to share the five precepts, a householder's guide to daily practice. This is going to help you understand the natural law of Gamma and five impactful decisions that you can either make in a wise way that produce wholesome results, or you could make them in an unwise way that'll produce unwholesome results. And I'll share that with you when we get to Tuesday evening. This is a little picture of my wife doing the yoga at one of her private clients' house. So Wednesday, the topics are loving kindness meditation. We're going to be starting off with that in the morning. I'm going to teach it to you very thoroughly, and then we're going to actually do it together as part of our guided meditation. This is going to help you to eliminate anger, hatred, ill will, frustration, agitation, annoyance. If you have negative self-talk in your mind, this is going to help you to eliminate that. Then I'm going to teach you what is Gamma and how does it affect me. Everything that the Buddha is teaching in one way or another is coming back to this natural law. But here we're going to go in and talk about some specific things related to the natural law itself. Then I'm going to teach you what is merit. This is a specific type of wholesome Gamma that you'll need to understand and be able to practice that. Then in the evening, we'll be doing loving kindness meditation together, either in the seated, lying, or standing position. And then I'm going to be sharing with you understanding and experiencing the jhanas. The light bulb is flickering. So for those of you guys that have studied with me in other courses or retreats, everything up to Wednesday morning, you might have already learned in one way or another. But again, I'm going to be honing in on the specifics related to the first stage of enlightenment. But by Wednesday afternoon, or actually Wednesday evening, I keep saying afternoon because I usually teach in the afternoon, but this is an evening. This is 6:30 p.m. I'm going to now be moving into things you haven't learned before. We're going to be talking about the jhanas. These are preliminary phases that the mind goes through before you get to the first stage of enlightenment. This is like an indication to you that you're putting together the teachings really well, because you're going to notice certain qualities of mind starting to arise. So we're going to go through and I'm going to explain these jhanas to you, because this is a important time in your practice, because you can start understanding that your mind is experiencing these certain qualities. And now you kind of shift your practice and start really honing in on the 10 fetters more closely. So I'll explain those to you on Wednesday, so you'll know what they are and you'll know that you're experiencing them, so that then you can start focusing more readily on getting to the first stage of enlightenment. Then Thursday morning, we'll start off with breathing mindfulness meditation. And then we're going to start learning about the five aggregates and the six sense bases. This is where you're understanding this human being that you are, understanding how this being functions and how it operates, so that you can now navigate the world as this being of being a human more closely. So I'll help you to understand those things. Then we're going to be discussing dependent origination as the highest law of nature. This is going to help you to understand discontentedness and the cycle of rebirth more closely. This is where you learn the 12 interlinking steps of what it's taking in order for your mind to become discontent, in order for you to experience rebirth. And this can be independently verified. This is the highest truth of the teachings of the Buddha. Then, while the Four Noble Truths is explaining to you right view, there's something called accomplishment in view. And you need to have accomplishment in view in order to get to the first stage of enlightenment. So I'll explain that to you on Thursday so that you can develop that and practice it. Then on Thursday evening, I'll help you to understand this eliminating the pollution of personal existence view. This is the first fetter. Of course, we're going to be doing loving kindness meditation prior to that. In this class or this retreat, I'm going to help you understand the first three fetters in detail. We're going to experience and have a class of each individual fetter for those first three, because that's what you need to eliminate in order to get to the first stage of enlightenment. Where in other courses and retreats, I kind of talk about these fetters and kind of introduce you to them. In this retreat, I'm going to spend an entire hour, hour and a half, talking about each individual fetter. I'm going to explain what it is. I'm going to explain the symptoms that you're experiencing because of these fetters and how it's impacting your life. I'm going to explain to you the solutions and the tools and the techniques of how to eliminate this pollution from your mind. And then I'm going to teach you how to know that it's actually been eliminated. So these are the four aspects of each fetter that I'm going to explain to you. I'm going to explain what it is, what the symptoms are, the tools and techniques to eliminate it, and then how to know that you've actually eliminated it from the mind. So I'm going to do that with the first fetter of personal existence view, getting the self out of the way. Then we're going to do this meditation on Friday morning to realize non-self, which connects to what I taught on Thursday evening. Then I'm going to go into this pollution of doubt so that you can master confidence and developing wisdom in your life. And the same thing, I'll explain what this fetter is, the symptoms of it, the tools and techniques to eliminate it, and how to know that you've actually eliminated it. Then I'm going to explain the fetter of wrong behavior and observances, helping you to master moral conduct and eliminating any kind of superstition. Again, what it is, the symptoms, the tools and techniques to eliminate it, and how to know that you've actually eliminated it. Then in the evening, after we come back from lunch, we'll do this meditation to realize non-self again, because I've done it once with you here and taught it to you. Here, we're going to do it again. Then I'm going to teach you how to determine if you've attained the first stage of enlightenment, because this is something that you're going to need to know, because it's a personal guide for you to help you plot your course towards enlightenment. Once you attain the first stage of enlightenment, you're not going to call up your mom and be like, "Hey mom, guess what? I attained the first stage of enlightenment. Aren't you proud of me?" You know, you're not going to post it on your Facebook page or anything like that, but you need to know for your own personal development. This might be something you talk about with your teacher, but you're most likely not going to talk about it with other people. But you need to know what it is in terms of how to get to this first stage of enlightenment, and then to know that you've actually attained it, because then you need to start focusing on the second stage and the third stage and the fourth stage. So that's why it's important for you to know how to determine if you've attained this first stage of enlightenment. And then we'll have that closing discussion that I mentioned as part of the wrap up, that if there's any questions that you kind of thought of throughout the week that you didn't quite get a chance to ask on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, maybe you asked all your questions on Monday, but then maybe after you were thinking about what I talked about on Monday, maybe Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you had a question that you just didn't get a chance to ask yet. So we'll have that wrap up as the very last thing to give you guys a chance to kind of freeform questions about anything and everything that you'd like to ask questions about. So let me pause here, see if you guys have any questions on our plan or our schedule and kind of how things are going to progress throughout the week. Do you guys have any questions on anything? No? Okay, let me see if our folks online have any questions. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here either. Okay, so this retreat is based on two books. The first book of the book series that I share, which is called Developing a Life Practice, The Path That Leads to Enlightenment. This is volume one of the book series. I have these books online. You can download them for free. You can take it and go print it if you like, or you can get printed copies here at the temple or on Amazon. Here at the temple, I just ask that you reimburse us for the printing cost. So if you would like a printed version, you can do that, or you can get them on Amazon or download them, or even go print them yourself. There's a print shop right down the street here from the temple. You could walk to it and they'll actually print it for you if you'd like to do it that way. So there's this first book, and you're not going to be able to read that entire book during this week, but just to know that that's what this retreat is based on. So you can read that at any time. And students oftentimes will read this book multiple times. And then the content on the first stage of enlightenment is based on this fifth book of the book series. It's volume five. It's titled The First Stage of Enlightenment, Stream Enter. And you can also get that one online. You can download it, take it and go print it. You can get printed versions here or on Amazon as well. So you can access it through this link of buddhadailywisdom.com/free Buddha books. Okay. So just to help you understand why I share these retreats and what my real goal is in sharing the teachings of the Buddha, is what I'm working towards is the restoration of the teachings of the Buddha so that people can understand the path to enlightenment more and more closely. We're at this low point in the teachings of the Buddha, and the Buddha predicted that this would occur, that we would get to this low point 2,500 years after his death, to the point where his teachings would be largely misunderstood by the vast majority of the world. And what I'm interested in doing is seeing the teachings of the Buddha come back into the world in such a way that we bring them into the world in an international language that the entire world can understand, like English, because now we have this wonderful language that everybody can learn and practice all across the world. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, this wouldn't have been possible because there's not as many people that understand the English language as there is today. But nowadays, by having the teachings of the Buddha in the English language, we can share them far and wide. We also have something called the internet that we can press a button and we can send information from here all the way to the other side of the world with just a blink of an eye. And we have travel, which the Buddha didn't really have easy access to during his lifetime. We can get on an airplane and we can be pretty much anywhere within 1 or 2 days. The Buddha didn't have that ability. So we live in a very unique time that we can share these teachings far and wide throughout the world, and we can really restore the teachings back into the world. So as you learn and you practice the teachings for yourself, this is helping you to get to enlightenment. And it's also helping to restore the teachings, because as you get to enlightenment and you gain the wisdom of what it takes to get to enlightenment, you will never forget that wisdom. By the time somebody gets to enlightenment, they will never forget the wisdom that it took for them to get to enlightenment. So as more and more people get to enlightenment, this is restoring the teachings of the Buddha back into the world. So you don't need to go out and convince other people to learn the teachings of the Buddha. You're doing your part by just learning and practicing. And then as people ask you, why are you so peaceful? Why are you always so joyful? Why do you always smile so much? You can explain to them, well, it's the teachings of the Buddha. And they're like, well, I'd like some of that. And you're like, okay, well, here it is, you know, go learn it, right? And slowly but surely, people decide that they would like to get rid of this anger and sadness and frustration. So my interest is to see these teachings of the Buddha be restored back into the world slowly but surely over the course of my life. And this is what I'm working on for the rest of my life. And these retreats and courses and books and resources that I offer all at no cost is helping that to occur. And you can see that the teachings are actually working, because I can assure you that these teachings of the Buddha lead exactly where he said they do, to this enlightened mental state where the mind's peaceful, calm, serene, and content with joy, where you'll never experience anger ever again in your life. And you can help restore the teachings for yourself by just learning and practicing getting to enlightenment. That's your part if you would like to be able to do that and see the truth for yourself. Essentially, by the time that these teachings get introduced in this way that the international world can learn and practice these teachings, It's like an entire species of beings can get to the enlightened mental state. Just like a lizard evolves, just like a crocodile evolves, it's an evolution of the species. Human beings are evolving. We've been evolving ever since we first came into the world. We can evolve beyond this anger and sadness and frustration and agitation. Sometimes we think that being angry and frustrated and having stress and anxiety is just part of the human condition, and you're always going to have that. But that's not actually true. This feelings of stress and anxiety and guilt and shame and fear and disappointment and resentfulness, this is not permanent. You can actually eliminate it. You don't have to sit with these feelings and just experience anger and sadness for the rest of your life. You can actually eliminate it if you understand how to do that. So we can evolve as a species. More and more people can get to this enlightened mental state. And as a collective society, we can evolve. The way that you get to enlightenment is not through training other people, it's through training your own mind. But as we each individually decide to train our own mind, as a species we evolve, and humanity becomes a more and more peaceful population of people, and this world becomes more and more peaceful. You know, someone might refer to this as heaven on earth. If everybody was enlightened in the world, it would be like heaven on earth, because nobody would be causing harm to each other. That's not where we are today. And if you do your work to get to enlightenment in this life, you will never be here when everybody is enlightened. But the work that we do in our lifetime will ensure that you can get to enlightenment, but then it'll also preserve the teachings for future generations so that future generations can get to enlightenment too. Because as you learn and practice the teachings, your parents will ask you questions, your brothers and sisters, your friends, your coworkers, if you end up having children or you already have children, or your life partners, people will ask you questions about what it is that, why are you so peaceful? Why are you so joyful? And slowly but surely, the teachings will be brought into the world and pulled into the world in that way. So what we do in this type of retreat and these courses, it really matters. It really matters that if we spend time learning and growing and developing, it matters for you that it improves the condition of your mind and your life, but it also is helping the world as well as you're learning and training and developing your mind. So I share, let's make the most of this retreat. Let's have a good time. Let's enjoy our time together. And with that said, it brings us to the activity or the excursion. If you guys would like to participate and you'd like to go out and have fun, there's this great market that they're setting up out there. And if you guys would like to walk around, get to know each other, spend some time drinking some smoothies, having some pad thai or spring rolls or whatever it is that you like to eat, we can go out and do those kinds of things. And just remember that it's up to each individual to make their own decisions. Some people might feel like they need to go home and get some rest. So feel free to do that. But if you'd like to come out on these excursions, they're here and available for you as an optional thing that you're welcome to go to. So is there any questions about the retreat or what we're planning to do over the next 5 days or the excursions or anything else?
In regards to the timing for the excursions and activities, apart from tonight, obviously about 1:30 after lunch here, would that be about accurate?
We're going to be taking the excursion at around 12:30. And in some cases, we're going to get in the transportation and we're going to go to a restaurant and eat, and then we'll go to the event. In other situations, we'll eat around here and then we'll just go to the excursion from there, like around 1:30. We'll meet back at the temple. But each time I'll explain to you what we're going to do so there won't be any confusion, and you'll know whether we're leaving together right away after we break from class or whether we're going to go eat first and then leave after that.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Any other questions? No? Okay. So for those of you guys online, I apologize that you can't come to the excursions, but you're more than welcome. If you get a plane to Chiang Mai and you'd like to come, or maybe some of you guys are in Chiang Mai and you're just watching online, you're welcome to come for the excursion if you like. Okay. So it's going to be a great time to go out and spend time with you guys. All right. Well, in that case, I'll just end today by inviting you guys to come to the excursion if you like. And if not, then perhaps I'll see you guys tomorrow morning at 9:00. I show up at 8:00 here each day and kind of set things up and get things moving in the right direction, opening up the air conditioning and the lights and the sound equipment and all of that stuff. So you guys can come at any point. And if you guys would like to get together and spend time together, that'd be wonderful. I'll start class right at 9 o'clock. And because we're going to be here into the evening hours, which is like 6:30 to 8:30, we're going to be finishing up at 8:30 p.m., which isn't typical in the way that I teach classes. You'll need to remember that as you leave at 8:30 or 8:45 or so forth, that this is a place where people sleep. This is a home, essentially a residence. So there's monks that are going to be sleeping and resting in their rooms. So as we come and go throughout the mornings and the afternoons and the evenings, we'll just need to be observant and kind of watching our voice, our tone of voice and our volume of the voice, and any kind of trash that we have, we need to be sure that we take that to the trash bins and stuff like that. So just be aware of that as you go, you come and go throughout the temple, that there's monks here that are sleeping in their various quarters, and it would be wise for us to watch our volume of our voice and things like that. So again, thank you all for coming to join for the retreat. It'll be wonderful to share these teachings with you guys. As you go, you can ask me any and all questions, whether it's in class or privately if you'd like to talk, or during the excursions, I'll go out with you guys and we can talk at those situations as well. So thank you all for deciding that you'd like to spend some time to learn and practice the teachings of the Buddha. I'm here to help you in whatever way you feel that would serve you best. I'm going to be sharing all these teachings with you, helping you learn meditation and all the other teachings of the Buddha. And then towards the end of our retreat, I'll even help you understand how to get continued support beyond our retreat, because you'll need support beyond this retreat as well. So if you'd like to come for the excursion today, we can just gather together outside at the tables, outside the classroom. And if not, perhaps I'll see you guys tomorrow or in another class. Have a very wonderful and lovely rest of your day and your evening. We'll see you next time. Sawadee khap. Sawadee khap. Sawadee khap.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings. A well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.